Hi, my name is Dr. Norm Blumenthal. I'm a clinical psychologist with a practice in Cedarhurst. I'm also director of bereavement and crisis intervention services for Lifeline and the educational director of the Harry and Bella Wexner Smicha Honors Program and Kol Elyon at REITS at Yeshiva University. Today I'm going to talk about a distinct topic within the area of marital therapy and family relationships, which is second marriages and blended families. A very important topic, and unfortunately one that's being increasingly necessary. A second marriage and a blended family can be something really wonderful, and I feel I have to start off that way because we're going to talk about some of the problems and challenges, and I'm certainly not here to discourage anyone who's been through a divorce or anybody who's been widowed from attempting a second marriage. It can be a wonderful experience, and we'll end on that note. What we're going to focus on, though, as I speak, are the potential pitfalls, are some of the challenges, not to discourage you, but to prevent what could be a less than desirable, even catastrophic ending. And in fact, it happens to be that there is a higher divorce rate among second marriages than there are among first marriages, but for very different reasons. Divorces and first marriages, research tends to show that the problems range from ennui, from boredom, from extramarital affairs, mental illness, abuse, those kind of situations. In second marriages, some of the research seems to show that the most common cause for it not working out isn't even so much the relationship between the partners, but the problems with integrating the children or conflict over how to raise the children or what roles various people have with regard to the children. Let's start. First of all, one of the problems with second marriages is and blended families is that they have an illusion of simplicity. They have been, over the years, very romanticized, and for understandable reasons. Someone coming out of a divorce, and very often divorces, particularly in the Orthodox Jewish community, are very painful ones. Someone surviving a spouse at a young age, an age when they shouldn't have lost a spouse to death, are lonely people, are bruised, are injured people, and the idea that they can remarry, they can start have a happy new family for themselves, for their children, is almost irresistible. And in my observation over the years, that's been part of the problem, part of the reason why sometimes people rush into these types of marriages, and sometimes where people's expectations are such that it breeds almost inevitable disappointment, even if everything is going as well as can be expected. So very important that someone goes into this with 20/20 vision, with their eyes wide open, knowing what can be reasonably expected and how to put together a second marriage. We'll start with dating, and dating the second time around. Dating post-divorce, dating post-widowhood. First of all, one rule: do not date out of desperation. What do I mean? People, again, coming out of a divorce, coming out of having unfortunately buried a spouse, are lonely people, are overwhelmed. They're one person doing the job of two. They're very lonely. Everything, their loneliness confronts them in everywhere they go. Every simcha that they go to alone, coming home to the job that's taxing two people, now suddenly having to be done by one. And therefore, people in that situation, understandably, are very anxious and sometimes desperate to get remarried. The problem is when you operate out of desperation, when you operate, when your neediness is dominating your thinking, you're more prone to make mistakes, you're more prone to overlook potential problems. It's a bit of a paradox, but very often what I recommend to people in this situation, and it's a hard recommendation to make, but very often what I will recommend in a situation like this is wait until you've got it under control. Wait until you have a system, it's working, you're managing. It's far from perfect, but you could almost say to yourself, if I have to, I can manage this way. And then you're not, when you start your dating process, you're not dating, again, out of desperation. You're not dating out of neediness. You're dating, you can date with some thinking, you can date, as we say, with seichel, and you're much more likely to make the right type of choice. Dating the second time around also is very different from dating the first time around. Dating when you're young, when you're starting a life together, is much more sort of carefree. is much more plunging. You really, as I'm sure many of us recall, you have no idea what you're getting into. And probably that's helpful. Sometimes knowing too much, we'd be hesitant. I can tell you personally, sometimes I'm sitting at weddings and watching the happy, carefree young couple walking down the aisle, and this cynic in me says, "Do you know what you're getting into? You know about yeshiva tuitions, mortgages, adolescence." I think if I opened my mouth, nobody would walk down the aisle. There is a certain carefree nature to dating the first time around. There's a certain, as I said, taking the plunge. Second time around, you have a pretty good idea what you're in for. You've already been through some very hard life experiences. You're older, you're more hardened, you're more realistic. Second time dating is much more pragmatic. Second time dating is time, obviously there has to be an attraction, there has to be a physical attraction, there has to be a psychological attraction. It has to make sense at that level. But there's also much of the discussion and much of the planning is going to be descriptions of your situation, going over what you went through, what are the lingering effects, what are the ages of the children, the needs of the children, the circumstances of the children. And it's the pragmatics of the relationship. Obviously, you can't foresee everything. And certainly, if you get too pragmatic, then there won't be any second marriages either. But the nuts and bolts of the life you've had and nuts and bolts of anticipating the life that you're going to have is going to be very much part of that courtship process. One of the debates in the field is, should someone in a second time around marry someone who had been through the same circumstances that they have been through? Should a divorcee marry a divorcee? Should a widow marry a widower? Or can one consider in those circumstances a single person? And there's no consensus, and I think part of the reason why there is no consensus is it varies from situation to situation. Clearly, the more familiar the circumstance of one spouse is, the better the other one will understand it. And you don't have some of the complications that you would have if a widow marries a divorcee, the widow not being familiar with issues of visitation and child support and sometimes the ongoing tension that exists, whereas for the divorcee, not being familiar with the trauma of losing a spouse, with some of maybe the lingering feelings that still exist. However, I know many situations where, again, divorcees marry widows or widowers, or where single people marry a divorcee or a widower, and it works. A lot of it has to do with, again, how much the cause for the end of the first marriage still exists, is still present, how much that dominates the person's life, and how recent it is. Certainly, if it's more recent, it's much more of an issue. If it's a little bit later, it may be less of an issue. So I wouldn't say that one should not at all date someone whose situation is so different. It probably prevents some complications if the circumstances are the same. A common mistake that people make in these situations are to over-involve the children. This is your marriage, it's not their marriage. Obviously, when you make your decision, you're going to factor in the needs of the kids, and you're going to consider whether this new spouse is someone who can relate to the children and can easily go into the role of a step-parent, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But the children do not have veto power. And people sometimes want to discuss it with the children and let them have a say, or want to introduce the children to the prospective spouse and see whether the prospective spouse gets along with them well and whether the children like that person. As I said, it's empowering children way beyond they should be empowered. And almost the implicit message is they may approve now and then later they can say, "No, I don't like it." And they can feel that they have the right to sabotage or actively lobby to end the marriage, which is not a wholesome or healthy thing. Not only that, but getting together when you're dating in a park and playing baseball is not at all representative of what the life will be like when you bring everybody together. You have to make that decision. The children don't make that decision. I generally, not everybody agrees with me, but I generally recommend that you don't introduce the children to the prospective spouse until you and that person have decided that you're getting married. Now, first of all, the children should know you're dating. I think that's fair. First of all, they'll know it because they'll see you getting dressed up, they'll see you disappearing more often, and there's nothing wrong with their knowing that you're involved in the dating process. But before you let them know that this particular person is someone that you're going to marry, you wait until you two have decided. You also don't wait until the whole world knows, and the children shouldn't find out by an announcement in the synagogue bulletin. Usually the best time to introduce the children to the prospective spouse, ease them into that relationship, is between the time that you and the prospective spouse have decided to get married and before you have publicly announced it. And during that period of time, so they at least find out before the whole world finds out, but they're not the ones making the absolute decision. And as I said, it's an exercise in futility to think that you're going to experiment and see what it's really like. Once you're married, one of the very important factors is the parameters and the sort of, if you will, rules of what are the roles of the step-parent versus the actual parent. I'm going to talk about situations where the children already have or have had a relationship with the parent who's not there. In other words, it would be very different if the child is an infant or a baby, where they're at that age, you might say, unfortunately, where they may not remember the parent is not there, whether the parent had passed away or whether the parent had totally abandoned the family. In that case, very often the step-parent then can come in and really be, for all practical purposes, the full parent. However, if they have had a relationship already, if there is an awareness at a palpable level of this parent, or there is ongoing relationship, as is usually the case in divorces where there's visitation and even sometimes shared custody, then the step-parent can't just waltz in and suddenly become a full parent. And that's a very common mistake made. At least early on, and possibly throughout, for that matter, the marriage, the step-parent has a distinct role that is different than the biological parent. The step-parent is an adult. The step-parent has a certain amount of authority, but in many respects is the deputy, or will have to defer to the biological parent in situations like this. In other words, the step-parent doesn't right away become, let's say, an example, the father or the mother. From the child's perspective, they already have a father or mother, and that you cannot usurp that role. It's interesting that one of the issues that come up particularly within the Orthodox community is how to address that step-parent. And outside the Orthodox community, it's not an uncommon practice to address the person by the first name. That's not always acceptable in many parts of the Orthodox community. So the question is, how do you address this step-parent? And the general consensus is that, especially for the younger children, we're not necessarily talking about teens or old, more likely older teens, or certainly already young adults, but for children, that they call the step-parent by some name that connotes the parent, but not the same one that their biological parent is called. So if their biological parent is called Abba, then the step-parent may be called Daddy or something along those lines. But it's interesting that I have been told in Europe before the war, when unfortunately not divorce wasn't so common, but widowhood was much more common, as we didn't have the kind of medical care that we have today, the step-parent was often referred to as aunt and uncle, or in Yiddish, Tanta and Feda. And it's interesting because very much the role of the step-parent could be seen very much as an aunt and uncle. They are an adult. They have to be treated with respect. If they are, if you will, babysitting, if they are the only parent present, they can enforce a rule, they can enforce a punishment, but it comes from the biological parent. In other words, a step-parent, particularly early on in the blended relationship, let's say classic kind of situation, child's supposed to go to sleep, child's not going to sleep, his or her role is not to then enforce it in a disciplinary fashion, but to say your mother or slash your father wants you to go to sleep in this time. If there is real rebellion, and very often there is, particularly early on, when children very often do resist the presence of the step-parent, even if they embrace them initially, then if there has to be a more strident intervention, then it would be very much like what an aunt or uncle or babysitter might say, which is when your mother slash father come home, I'm going to have to tell them, and they may punish me, or they may have, and then that parent then institutes the punishment, not the step-parent. So the step-parent is in a semi-parental role, is, as I said, a delegate of the biological parent, but shouldn't quickly or naturally assume an equal parental role as they would if they had both, parented this child. excuse me for a second. Now, in fact, the research actually shows that the first 2 years are the hardest years in blended families or reconstituted families. So it really is a matter of sometimes waiting and waiting patiently. There can be situations, and it varies from situation to situation, where ultimately a step-parent really becomes like a parent in that respect. But if there's some doubt, the default position would be really much more to defer to the other parent. Another, by the way, very important consideration, I probably should have mentioned this during dating, but I will mention it now, the financial arrangements should be set right from the start. What they are really depends on, you know, your circumstances and how you arrange it, et cetera. But to avoid conflict and avoid differences, who's responsible for what? What is the, very often there are differences in terms of income, as much as you can to try to set that in also right from the start before the relationship comes together. And again, it might sound disappointing, but you don't right away become one big happy family. You don't right away become this totally cohesive, functioning family, as most of us hope we have when we have a marriage and a marriage that lasts. You are, in many respects, two families and one family at the same time. For example, it's very important that the children from each family maintain their distinct identity. Very often, most of the times, they will keep their last name. But even if you can, and I know you can't always anticipate that, if they have different parts of the house or that they have their own unique, distinct lives together and apart, it helps preserve their original relationship. It helps reinforce in the reality that they have another parent who is either living someplace else because of a divorce or someplace else because of a death, but that parent really is their parent. Another very important part of a blended or second marriage working is to, as much as possible, keep the past out of the present. You can't totally, but as much as possible, some of the pain, the injury, the hurt should be relegated to the past. That doesn't mean you can't talk about it. That doesn't mean you can't share it. Doesn't mean you can't recall it and recall the pain, or to the extent that it impinges on your current marriage, to address it. But a big mistake would be to suggest to have such a strong reaction. Let's say the new spouse does something relatively harmless, but maybe a little bit inconsiderate, but in more extreme form reminds you of the conduct or behavior of the previous spouse. This would be particularly true of a divorce, not to overreact, not to bring that into the current marriage, to keep those differentiations clear, and in situations of widowhood, the pain and the anguish or the loss should be as much as possible kept to a minimum. It certainly is a Jewish tradition that people, when they remarry after widowhood, do not keep pictures of the previous spouse in a public area. The children can have in their room to remember their mother, father, but not in a public area, not to visit the cemetery, to not bring in that relationship so the new spouse doesn't feel like there's somebody else there as well. Similarly, by the way, if there's a single person, very often sometimes when you marry someone who's single and if it's later on and the person has been through some very painful experiences in terms of previous dating and relationships that didn't work out, again, not to bring that into the current relationship. Let me conclude, because I have, and I'm always worried I'm going to be discouraging, and I'm talking about such negativity that people will abandon the whole idea of remarriage. It's a wonderful experience, and it is incredibly reparative and therapeutic. There's a technique we use for children who have nightmares. Sometimes a child wakes up in the middle of the night and may have a nightmare. One of the techniques we'll recommend to parents is inform the child that he wrote that dream. That dream was in his head. And he can now change the ending. And so we suggest to him, how would you like to change the ending? And of course the kid will say, well, instead of the monster eating me up, I kill the monster or something like that. And then they feel better. That's very much what second marriages and blended families can be when they work and when you go into it realistically and with the proper expectations. You can change the end of a nightmare and turn it into a very pleasant experience and dream. Thank you.